Okay, so picture this. You're a law student. Maybe you just landed your first internship and you walk into this new office, right? And the vibe is just off.
Oh, yeah.
There are crude jokes flying around. People are looking at things they shouldn't be. And you're thinking, hold on a sec, isn't some of this stuff illegal?
You're hitting on a huge question for new lawyers. When does your average everyday office crudeness become illegal harassment?
Exactly. And that is what today's deep dive is all about.
It is. And to tackle that question, we are looking at a case out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Ochiltree v. Skolin Productions from 2003.
Ochiltree is so fascinating because it really shows us how courts struggle with those really broad anti-discrimination laws when we have to apply them to, like, real-world messy situations.
It's like a great case.
It is. And it shows us this debate about what exactly makes a workplace hostile, what an employer has to do about it.
Yeah, it's really about the employer's responsibility.
So as we go through Ochiltree today, I really want us to keep two big questions in mind.
Yeah.
First, how do courts decide if what's happening is actually illegal harassment based on sex? And then second, how much does the employer have to know and what do they have to do about it to face legal consequences?
I think those are the key issues when we talk about employer liability.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So to really dive in, let's set the scene.
Okay.
Our case centers around Lisa Ochiltree, and she's the only woman working in this production shop with like 10 or 11 men.
Oh, wow.
Right off the bat, you can kind of see how that could be a recipe for problems.
Yeah, you can definitely imagine how some problems could come up in that kind of environment.
And that's exactly what happened. Things got so bad that she ended up suing.
So what exactly went down in the shop?
Well, according to the case documents, it seems like things escalated pretty quickly.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about her male coworkers using mannequins to simulate sex acts right there on the shop floor.
Oh my goodness.
And this wasn't just like a one-time thing. It sounds like it was happening pretty often, sometimes right in front of her as she was trying to work.
Wow, so it was in plain view.
And the case gets into some really explicit details.
What kind of details?
Well, there are descriptions of explicit photos and songs being shared openly, and then the really graphic sexual comments. I mean, we were talking about direct quotes that are in the court documents, like, "Come to me, baby. Your breath smells like cum."
No way they were actually saying that kind of stuff out loud.
Apparently so. And that quote was even sung to her opera style.
You've got to be kidding me.
I know, it's pretty shocking. And the court really focused on those details as proof that this was beyond just like some locker room talk.
Makes sense.
But it gets even crazier than that. There was this book of pierced genitalia that was being passed around.
Okay.
And one of the coworkers actually went up to Lisa, opened the book right to the centerfold, and asked her, "Lisa, what do you think about this?"
Oh gosh, that is so inappropriate.
I know, right? And the court really zoomed in on this idea that this wasn't just like a few isolated incidents.
Yeah, because we see that a lot where it's just like a one-off comment or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here it was constant. This kind of behavior was just everywhere, and it seemed like it was happening pretty much every day.
So it's just the culture.
Pretty much. And the kicker is that her supervisor, Harold Hirsch, knew about all of this.
He was aware of what was going on.
Yeah, Lisa complained to him multiple times, but he just didn't do anything about it.
Oh, wow. So he was completely turning a blind eye to all of this.
It seems that way. And, you know, as we get into the legal stuff later, that's really important when we talk about the employer's responsibility.
I can see how that would play a big role.
Absolutely. So after putting up with all of this for a while, Lisa was eventually fired in 1995, and she decided, that's it. I'm taking them to court.
Yeah, I can't say I blame her.
So that brings us to the actual legal journey of the case. And it wasn't a smooth ride for Lisa.
I bet.
The first big hurdle was in the U.S. District Court. The judge actually sided with the production company and granted them summary judgment.
Wait, so remind me, what does that mean exactly?
Sure. So summary judgment is when a court basically says, hey, there's no real disagreement about the facts of the case. And based on the law, one side wins automatically without needing a full trial.
Oh, got it.
So in this case, the district court basically said there wasn't enough evidence to hold the company responsible for what happened to Lisa.
But I thought you said she had all this evidence, like the comments, the book, the mannequins.
She did, but the court didn't think it was enough at that stage, so she appealed.
Okay, so what happened at the appeal?
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals looked at everything and said, no, wait a minute. There are definitely some issues here that a jury needs to decide. So they vacated the summary judgment and sent the case back down for a full-blown trial.
Oh, so they basically said this is a big enough deal that we need a jury to weigh in.
Exactly. And at the trial, Lisa actually won.
Really?
Yeah, the jury sided with her, and they awarded her two types of damages: compensatory damages to cover things like her emotional distress, and then punitive damages, which are meant to really punish the company and make sure they don't do this kind of thing again.
So it was a pretty big win for her.
It was a huge win, but of course the company appealed again.
Of course they did.
And this time, the case went all the way up to the entire Fourth Circuit for what's called an en banc hearing.
So for those of us who don't speak legalese, what does en banc mean?
It basically means that instead of just a small panel of judges, all of the judges on the Fourth Circuit got to hear and decide on the case.
Oh, wow. So this was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, en banc hearings are usually reserved for cases that are really important or where there are conflicting decisions in the circuit.
I see.
And their decision was split. They upheld the compensatory damages, but they reversed the punitive damages.
Oh, so they agreed that Lisa had been harmed, but they weren't willing to punish the company.
Exactly. And that really shows us the different levels of proof needed for different types of damages under the law.
So you're saying that even though the court agreed that company did something wrong, it wasn't bad enough to warrant punishment.
That's basically it. And the fact that this case went through so many appeals really highlights how difficult it is to apply these anti-discrimination laws in the real world.
It sounds like there's a lot of gray area.
There is. So let's take a step back for a second and break down what it actually takes to win a hostile work environment case under Title VII.
Yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty legal stuff.
So to make a long story short, there are four main things someone has to prove to win.
Okay, shoot.
First, the conduct has to be unwelcome, meaning you didn't ask for it or encourage it, and you genuinely found it offensive.
That makes sense. You can't be participating in the offensive behavior and then turn around and say you were harassed.
Right. And that's why documenting everything is so important.
Definitely good advice.
The second thing is that the harassment has to be because of your sex or another protected characteristic like your race or religion.
Right. So it can't just be that you don't like your coworker. It has to be connected to something like your gender.
Exactly. And this is actually a really tricky point that we'll come back to later.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
The third thing is that the conduct has to be severe or pervasive enough to actually change your work environment and make it abusive.
So we're not talking about a one-off comment here, right?
No, it has to be a pattern of behavior that happens often enough or is bad enough to really affect your ability to do your job.
Like a constant barrage of offensive jokes or something.
Exactly. And the last thing you have to prove is that the employer is responsible in some way.
Oh, so you have to show that the company itself did something wrong.
Right. Usually this means proving that they knew about the harassment, but didn't take any steps to stop it.
Which brings us back to Lisa's supervisor and how he didn't do anything when she complained.
Exactly. So with all that in mind, the two big questions in the Ochiltree case were, first, was the harassment really because of sex? And second, did the company know enough about what was happening to be hit with those big punitive damages?
Okay, so let's tackle the first question. Was the harassment in this case actually because of sex?
Right. So the majority of the judges on the Fourth Circuit said yes, even though the behavior wasn't always specifically about Lisa being a woman. The context made it clear that she was targeted because she was the only woman in this very male-dominated environment.
So they were looking at the big picture, not just individual comments.
Exactly. And they said that even if the sexual jokes and stuff weren't directly aimed at her being a woman, they still created a hostile environment for her because of her sex.
I can see that.
The judges really emphasized this idea that you have to consider the whole situation, the gender dynamics of the workplace, the frequency of the behavior.
So they weren't just looking at whether they used the word woman or something like that.
Exactly. And they pointed out that Lisa was basically dealing with this daily stream of sexual humiliation, and that it was at least partly because she was the only woman in that shop.
Okay, so the majority said the harassment was because of sex, but you mentioned there were some other opinions in this case.
Right. One of the judges, Judge Williams, actually dissented, meaning he disagreed with the majority.
So what did he think?
His argument was basically that, yes, the stuff going on in that workplace was vulgar and inappropriate, but it wasn't really about Lisa being a woman.
Really? So he didn't think it was motivated by her gender?
That's his take. He pointed out that the men in the shop were also exposed to a lot of the same vulgar behavior, and he called it equal opportunity vulgarity.
Hmm. So his logic was that if everyone was hearing and seeing this stuff, then it couldn't be discrimination against Lisa specifically.
That was his reasoning. And then there's another judge, Judge Niemeyer, who wrote a concurring opinion.
Concurring meaning he agreed with the outcome, but maybe not for the same reasons as the majority.
Exactly. And Judge Niemeyer actually agreed with Judge Williams on the legal standard that the harassment has to be discriminatory to be illegal.
Okay, but...
But he thought that in this case, the fact that Lisa was the only woman surrounded by all this sexual perversion, as he called it, made it discriminatory even if individual comments weren't always directed at her gender.
So he thought the context made a big difference.
Yes, and that's what makes this case so interesting. Even among these experienced judges, there was this real debate about when does offensive behavior cross the line into illegal discrimination?
It's a tough question.
It is, and I think that's a valuable lesson for any law student trying to understand these concepts.
Absolutely. So what about the punitive damages? The jury awarded them to Lisa, but the Fourth Circuit said no dice.
Right, so here's the thing. The court basically said there are different standards for giving out money to make someone whole versus giving out money to punish someone.
Okay, so compensatory damages are about making the victim whole, and punitive damages are about punishing the bad guy.
Exactly. And the court said compensatory damages were fine in this case because the company knew about the harassment and didn't stop it.
They had that supervisor who was aware of everything but didn't do anything.
Right. But for punitive damages, they needed more. They needed proof that the company acted with malice or reckless indifference to Lisa's rights.
So basically that the company as a whole, not just the supervisor, was intentionally being horrible or didn't care at all about her rights.
And the court said they just didn't see enough evidence of that. So while the company was definitely negligent, maybe even intentionally indifferent, it wasn't enough to warrant punishment.
Okay, so that's an important distinction to keep in mind.
It is, and it really highlights the importance of having good policies and procedures in place to deal with these kinds of issues.
Absolutely. If you're an employer, you need to take these complaints seriously and investigate them properly.
Exactly. And yeah. You can't just sweep things under the rug and hope they go away.
Bad idea.
So what are the big takeaways from all of this for us as future lawyers?
Well, I think the biggest one is that context matters a lot in these cases.
How so?
Well, the court in Ochiltree wasn't just looking at isolated incidents or specific words. They were looking at the whole picture, the gender dynamics, the frequency of the behavior, and the impact it had on Lisa.
So it's not just about what was said, but also who said it to whom and in what kind of environment.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important lesson for us to remember as we advise clients.
Absolutely. And we also saw how important it is to understand the different standards for different types of damages.
Right. Just because someone is found liable for harassment doesn't automatically mean they'll be hit with those big punitive damages.
You need that extra level of proof of malice or recklessness.
Exactly. So I think Ochiltree is a really good example of how Title VII isn't meant to be a general politeness code.
Yeah, it's not about stopping every offensive joke or comment.
Right. But it does step in when the harassment is so bad, so pervasive, and connected to something like your sex, that it creates a truly hostile work environment.
And it's interesting to see how even experienced judges can disagree about where that line is.
It really highlights the complexity of these issues.
It does, and it leaves us with a lot to think about.
For sure.
So for all the law students out there, I want to leave you with this question. Do you agree with the majority that the harassment Lisa faced was because of her sex? Or do you side with the dissenting judge who saw it as just general vulgarity that everyone was exposed to? What do you think?
It's a tough one, and I think there's a lot of room for debate.
There is, and I think as future lawyers, we need to be prepared to grapple with these kinds of questions because the law is often about navigating these gray areas.
Absolutely, and I think Ochiltree is a great example of that.
It is. Well, on that note, I think we've covered a lot of ground today.
We have.
So until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and remember, context is everything.